Welcome to the Comp Bio Cafe. I'm your host, Melissa.
And I'm Janae.
And today we're excited to chat with Dr. Stacy Finley. As a reminder, if you have questions or comments to share, please email them to podcast@blackwomencompbio.org or leave us a voicemail at 1-302-715-2922. We may share your responses here during the show. All right, so I'm going to start off by introducing our guest. Dr. Stacy Finley is a holder of the Nicole A. and Thuan Q. Farm Professorship and Professor of Biomedical Engineering at the University of Southern California. Dr. Finley received her BS in Chemical Engineering from Florida A&M University and obtained her PhD in Chemical Engineering from Northwestern University. She completed her postdoc training at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of Biomedical Engineering. Dr. Finley joined the faculty at USC in 2013, and she leads the Computational Systems Biology Lab. Dr. Finley has a joint appointment in the Department of Chemical Engineering and Materials Science, and she's a member of the USC Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center. She is also a standing member of the MAB study section at NIH, and her research has been supported by grants from the NSF, NIH, and American Cancer Society. Welcome, Dr. Finley.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to join you.
Yeah, so we usually ask all of our guests this question to gain insight into their unique perspective in the field. So how would you describe your relationship to CompBio?
I have been working in computational modeling really since my time in college. So I did a research project my senior year and wrote a thesis, an undergraduate research thesis for the project. And it was all about modeling. We were using reaction diffusion equations, partial differential equations to study how metabolites were interacting with one another and moving around in a goldfish skeletal muscle. And it was related to the goal of metabolic engineering. So understanding where the metabolite was going so that we could then predict where a drug would go and how it would react with other metabolites and species in the muscle. And so it was really from there that I learned more about the power of computational modeling. And so when I decided to go to grad school, I was almost purely focused on looking for research projects that had a focus on mathematical modeling. So it really was that summer research that went into the school year that really got me interested in computational modeling. Of course, right, you're learning just like a tiny bit, a small fraction of the whole field. But even from that small introduction, I got really excited about the power of modeling.
Nice. And then this is probably like a large question, but how do you feel that your expertise has grown from the small undergraduate research experience to now in terms of applying modeling to your research?
Yeah, so I definitely think I've learned more about the kinds of models that can be used to study biology and other questions. Definitely learned more about the tools that are used, some of the limitations and the advantages of each, but then also learning more about the computational biology side in terms of bioinformatics and data analysis. And so I think that I've learned a lot by going to conferences, by hearing people present their research. And still, I mean, my work is, you know, a small part of a broader field, but I do think that at least I have an idea of some of the advantages and the strengths of computational biology and mathematical modeling that then lets me see, well, where could I apply this particular type of model and how could it be beneficial to better understand biology?
Mm. So, Stacy, while we're here, how might you tease apart what you do in mathematical biology from the broader comp bio scope, because I feel like some of it we might be using interchangeably, but I do think you sit at a very different intersection than maybe what like me and Melissa do. So how would you describe that to a broader audience?
I think that there's a nice connection between computational biology and mathematical modeling. Mainly, we could see it more as a passing information between the two. So computational biology, in my mind, is more about data analysis, understanding intricate patterns of large-scale complex data, and trying to identify either patterns or targets or something meaningful in the data. And then I think that's a nice handshake to make with mathematical modeling, because then with a mathematical model, we can learn more about the mechanistic insight and the mechanisms that give rise to that observation. And so I do think that they're quite distinct, but they're very complementary. And so I learn from data sets, from colleagues who are doing more comp bio and bioinformatics and data analysis, and then say, oh, this might be something really interesting to dig deeper into with a mechanistic, predictive mathematical model.
So how long have you, I guess, been interested in science, and how is that? I mean, Melissa asked already how maybe some of your work has evolved, but where did it all start for you?
Yeah, I think I got really interested in chemistry. I believe it was ninth grade. I had a chemistry teacher. His name was Ashley Elbel, E-L-B-L. I will never forget it. He was like the super stereotypical chemist, like tall and nerdy and just like all about the book. But he passed along that passion for science and chemistry in all of his lectures and even in like interacting with him outside of the classroom. And so that really got more excited about chemistry in particular, and then more broadly about asking scientific questions and having a strong basis to evaluate and answer those questions. And so then I got, you know, exposed to physics, and then, of course, the mathematical side of it and calculus came into play. And so when I was sort of deciding, you know, what do I want to be when I grow up, it was trying to marry chemistry, physics, and math. And it was a very, like, intentional, almost data-driven decision. Like, I wanted to incorporate things that I enjoyed and appreciated with the things that I was good at. And it was that combination that said, oh, well, let's combine chemistry and physics and mathematics. But then the other side is, well, for what purpose? And so then I learned more about engineering, right? And how engineers solve problems. I said, well, maybe there is a subset of problems that I would be able to solve using chemistry, physics, and math. And so that's where I got into engineering, and then more specifically in the subdiscipline of chemical engineering. So I really think that my enthusiasm, at least in like specific science subjects, came in ninth grade. I think I was interested more even earlier than that in science, just by, you know, doing science projects with my dad or different things like that. So maybe a seed was planted earlier on in elementary school, but it was really solidified and nurtured in high school.
I love that your science journey started from such a young age, and you have those like vivid memories. What, like, can you speak to, I guess, what other role models you had throughout your journey that kind of continue to light the spark?
Yeah, I think when I got to college, so I went to Florida A&M University, a historically Black university in Tallahassee, Florida. And the very first semester, I had Calculus 1. And the professor was Dr. Sonia Stevens, a Black woman, like super intelligent, so in command of the material and the classroom. And I just, first of all, I was in awe of her. Dr. Stevens. She was just amazing. And so seeing her in the classroom, you know, knowledgeable and able to present it in a way that I could understand and engage with, that was very powerful for me. Mm-hmm. And I saw myself like reflected in her and started to think about the possibility of pursuing more of an advanced degree. You know, as a freshman in college, it wasn't, you know, 100% clear to me that I would go on to get a PhD, but I just saw the possibility of doing something like that. Mm-hmm. And it happened that when she was teaching this class, she was pregnant, like 7 months pregnant. And I was like, man, she can be on top of her math, on her science, an amazing instructor and teacher, and also, you know, presumably, right, becoming a mom. Mm-hmm. And then I went to her office hours and she was great. Like Dr. Stevens was fantastic. And to have mm-hmm. that be part of my first experiences at FAMU was mm-hmm. very, very impactful. When mm-hmm. I did go on and get a PhD, I emailed Dr. Stevens and said, you don't even realize the impact that mm-hmm. you had on me. But it was very, very strong, very powerful. Mm-hmm. And so that was probably definitely a role model that has played a big part in just seeing what the opportunities could be for my own career.
Oh, I love that so much. Like, I hope that listeners will kind of be able to hear the impact that the role models from your dad mm-hmm. to your professors that they have mm-hmm. on, I guess, just kind of guiding you into this field.
Had you had any Black professors or teachers before then?
So I did have Black teachers at the high school that I went to. It was an arts and science magnet school. Mm-hmm. I definitely remember Black teachers in English and in some of the life sciences. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't to the same extent. And also just, you know, being a very impressionable freshman in college, it had a different impact. So, yeah, it was very powerful.
I feel like that's such an important time to encounter that. And also on top of that, have them actually be a great person, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of us could have used, even if it, you know, even if you did have a good time in some of your classes, sometimes just that extra layer of understanding and visibility and just being seen really helps people to feel connected to the work. I know I definitely could have used some of that representation much sooner, but here I am. Sorry, Melissa, did I cut you off?
No. Yeah, so continue to walk us through this journey. We're curious to know, at what point did you decide to pursue academia?
Yeah, so I was on a fellowship, a scholarship at FAMU that was sponsored by different industrial partners. And so I was paired with the Procter & Gamble company. And so what that meant is that I had to do a summer internship, at least one, with Procter & Gamble. And so I was paired with Procter & Gamble. I did a summer internship the summer after my first year at FAMU. And I was placed in Cincinnati, Ohio, in something called glycerin refinery. So glycerin is an additive to lots of different household and everyday products. And so it seemed like the perfect job, the opportunity for the perfect job, because I was using thermodynamics and I was using heat exchangers and understanding heat transfer and seeing it in action in an industrial process. And so I thought that it would be, yes, this is like where I'm going to go for a job after I graduate. They already know me. I'm going to make a great impression. And I did make a great impression, but it wasn't the right fit for me. I was in manufacturing, and that meant like hard hat, steel-toed boot, protective eyewear. And it wasn't like intellectually stimulating or creative in any way. It was more, how can we make this process as efficient as it can be so that it can make more profits for the company. Mm-hmm. But I had to finish the internship. I did meet lots of great people. I learned more about the application of chemical engineering in this industry. I ended up doing two more internships with Procter & Gamble, still in manufacturing, all three summers. But that last summer is when I had just decided to also do a research internship or a research project for my senior year. So the summer before my senior year, I was still working for Procter & Gamble, but I was starting to prepare for that research project. So in the evenings, I was reading papers and I was doing just like preliminary work to understand sort of the field of that mathematical model that I would be exposed to. And just having those two very different experiences almost right at the same time was helpful because I could compare and contrast how I felt when I went into my internship during the day and compared to how I felt when I was reading papers in the evening. And I was much more energized and enthusiastic about the research part. And so that's where I said, well, maybe if I don't, you know, pursue this industrial position, then I can learn more about the career opportunities that are available in research. So, but I should say, right, if I had been placed not in manufacturing, but instead in research and development, then I could have taken a totally different route. Like I might not be a faculty member right now, but because I was in manufacturing and it wasn't exciting and it wasn't keeping me up at night, like reading the papers and wanting to learn more was, then I was able to make that decision to lean more into the research. I finished my that summer. I got into research during my final year at FAMU. And then I said, oh, well, maybe I should apply to grad school to learn more about the different kinds of models that I could apply and more about just how to perform research at a higher level. And so it's really that comparison over those 3 or 4 months that I decided to apply to grad school, still not really knowing that I would stay in academia, but at least have more of a tool set where I could be more, you know, competitive at applying for research and development jobs. So that's how I got into research and got into like that idea of going to graduate school. And then as a PhD student, I had the chance to do some of the tasks that you are, you know, hired to do as a faculty member. So I had the chance to mentor undergraduate students in a research project. There was a teaching apprenticeship program at in the department where I was at at Northwestern. And so I had the chance to see what it might look and feel like to be a faculty member, at least some of the tasks that I would be asked to do. And I enjoyed mentoring. I enjoyed being in the classroom. Obviously, I enjoyed doing research. And so those things coming together said, well, maybe I can stay in academia and pursue faculty position. So that really like the research side compared to the industrial internship, and then seeing some glimpses of what life as a faculty member might be like that really led me down the career path to staying in academia and becoming a faculty member.
So what do you think were some decisions you made at the PhD stage to kind of help prepare you for the next step, which was, I think, a postdoc, but, you know, you knew that you were getting some exposure to academia in general. Maybe the question is, what advice would you give to people at the PhD stage right now who would be interested in the faculty route?
Yeah, I think from my experience, I think having the chance to try out different opportunities and experiences. So having that, you know, comparison between the internship and research was very eye-opening to me and very influential in the decision to go to grad school. So my advice would be to try different things out as a graduate student. Of course, focusing in on your research, making that a priority so that you get the degree, but having the opportunity to see, oh, well, maybe I can shadow someone or I can learn more about what this career opportunity might look like, or maybe ask your PhD advisor, can I learn more about what it looks like to write a grant? Or what it looks like to mentor a student. Maybe you can have the opportunity to mentor someone. If you have the chance to do an internship during your PhD, that's also another opportunity to see what other career trajectories look like. But I just think that you'll never know what's not a good fit or what you're not interested in if you're not even exposed to it.
So you finish your PhD, you go on to the next step and eventually end up at USC. What stood out to you about the institution? Maybe what was your application journey like, if you remember any of that? But since you've been there since 2013, tell us more about that if you can.
Yeah, I started at Johns Hopkins as a postdoc fellow in 2009. And I was really excited about the research. I didn't know anything about cancer research or the formation of new blood vessels and tumors or anything, but I knew the mathematical basis and perspective that I could bring to these kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. It was a really great working environment. I was there for about 2.5 years, and then I decided to apply for faculty positions, mainly because, a postdoc is supposed to be a relatively short period of time just to sort of help launch your career. And so it was really timely. It was time to apply for independent positions. I started by just having maybe 10 schools on my list. And then I talked to my PhD advisor and she encouraged me to broaden the list again, to see what's out there and where might be an institution that I could connect with and feel that it would be a good place for my research. So I broadened it to probably 25 or 28 schools. And, you know, applying for a job, like trying to get a job is a job in and of itself.
Yes.
So you have to find what institutions you're interested in. You have to, you know, be really clear and explicit about what you bring to the table and why it would be a good fit for you to go there. You have to do research about who's already there and how they would complement your own work. And so it was a lot of work, but I ended up applying for almost 30 positions. And there is a little bit of a wrinkle in this plan too, because I had a two-body opportunity. So I met my husband actually at FAMU. We both went to Northwestern for grad school. We both ended up at Hopkins for postdoc. And so when we were applying for faculty positions, we were also somewhat limited in terms of our geographical location because I had a 2-year-old daughter at the time. And so it wasn't so much of an option at all to be in different cities. So we had to find a city that had maybe more than one institution, so that there could be options for both of us. But I applied to USC. I went out for the interview and just thought that it would be a really good fit for my research. They were trying to recruit faculty members in this newer direction for the department, which was more on cellular and molecular bioengineering. That's right where I fit in. They already had a long track record of computational modeling and analysis. So I thought that I could fit in with that too and have mentors who had been funded by NIH and were very successful to help as I started my career. And so it was really just a quite natural fit and very timely to apply to USC. And then they also invited my husband to apply there. And they were really quite proactive about finding a solution to our two-body opportunity. And that USC definitely stood apart from other institutions where we were applying.
Yeah, I feel like that's something I didn't really learn about until like now, where just thinking about how different institutions cater to couples having to move together. I've seen where cross institutions in the area have recruited different couples based on like collaborations just to ensure that both people can find a job in the same area. So it kind of brings a lot of humanity to like the science that we do. We try and be professional, but at the same time, we have lives, we're people, you know, we have families. Can you talk about the origins of the Computational Systems Biology Lab at USC?
Yes. So, systems biology is a field where you're really focusing in on how small pieces of biological systems give rise to larger emergent behaviors. So instead of just looking at one molecular species that participates in this reaction, or even just looking at one reaction at a time, it's really focused on looking at how that single reaction or that one molecular species influences a larger system. And so in my case, we were very focused on signaling pathways, so we could try to understand how one enzyme or one species is influencing broadly the activation of this signaling pathway. And that's also a different scales, right? Now, if that pathway is activated, you can also see, well, how does it influence the cell's behavior? So moving up in scale and also in complexity. And so I really only learned about systems biology in my last, 6 to 9 months at Northwestern and grad school, but got really excited about the power of systems biology and how it could be used to answer lots of different kinds of questions. I was quite intentional in looking for a postdoc where I could use mathematical modeling that's applied to human health and disease. So I found this great lab at Hopkins, and they were working on tumor and cancer systems biology. So it was a nice place to learn more about the applications of mathematical modeling in cancer. And it was helpful for me because that really is the basis of my own lab. We do a lot of cancer systems biology research, but more broadly, we're really just interested in how small pieces of a puzzle influence the larger system. And we're focused on using mathematical modeling and computational analysis to understand how the system behaves and how it might be vulnerable. Specifically, if you're talking about cancer systems biology, how the system might be exploited or targeted to inhibit or block tumor growth. So it's all with, again, this engineering mindset too of trying to answer and solve a problem, but from a systems, a larger perspective, and using mathematical modeling.
That's so cool. How did you kind of decide? And then, sorry, we're gonna switch in a second, but how did you decide what went into the process of, I have all this experience. I've done my PhD, I've done my postdoc. This is what I want to build a lab out of. What was that process like for you?
I think it takes time for sure. So probably, a year leading up to the time that I was going to apply for faculty position, I started to think about, well, what expertise do I have? What am I learning that, and the combination of what I learned as a PhD student and what I'm doing as a postdoc, that combination is pretty unique, right? So how could I, expand that into an independent research problem, research program? And what specific questions would I be uniquely prepared and able to answer? And so it is a little bit of, thinking about, well, what kind of perspective do I bring to this problem? And even what kind of problems do I want to even, pursue? So it takes time to identify what your interests are and then what you uniquely bring to the table that then you can emphasize and highlight in the faculty application.
And for those listening, we're planning on later in the year to have more talks and panels about the academic application process. So I feel like some of these discussions might reemerge then. Okay, so Stacey, while you were away, we decided that Ijama would ask a couple questions. I think there are three questions here, more about your research, and then Melissa will hop back in. So, Ijama, if you're ready, you can come on in.
Thank you. Yeah, so thank you so much. I think I'm really excited about your work, to be honest. I had a little bit of a fangirl moment. But right now, I think what I'm really interested in, like you kind of recently published a paper that focused on basically modeling like composite apoptotic responses in tumors. And I'm just really curious, like, I guess in your perspective, I guess what role and how, what role does, like, I guess these types of theoretical modeling, like, play or redefine the way we think about cell communication? For those of you who are listening, this question is really focused on how in the current field, when we're trying to build new tools or trying to create new models, how we are able to, I guess, use them to define novel pathways. That's something that is still, like, in discussion and kind of we're all trying to figure out. But I would be really interested to hear your perspective on that.
Right. So we have a model that looks at signaling pathway that leads to apoptosis, so programmed cell death. This is really what we want cells to do, tumor cells to do, is to die in a very systematic and intentional way. And tumor cells have evolved to be able to resist apoptosis. And so in this model, we have the canonical, you know, pretty well-studied pathway that leads from the cell surface receptor called FAS receptor being activated by its ligand and then activating this cascade of reaction that leads to activation of a species called caspase-3, which is sort of a mediator of cell death. And so in this type of work, we are not identifying new pathways. We're not identifying new targets. We're really taking something that's already pretty well known and understanding at least the dynamics, right? Because this is a dynamic model. We can see how the amounts of each of those species along the pathway evolves over time. And we can also change model parameters to say, oh, well, what would happen if this reaction rate is occurring more rapidly than what we believe is happening inside of cancer cells? Or what happens if we turn off that reaction altogether? So I really feel that the power of modeling in cancer research is to ask the what if question in a quantitative and mechanistic way to say, again, what happens if I turn this reaction off or if I amplify the rate at which this reaction happens? And then we see, well, how does the signal proceed and ultimately make a prediction about whether the cancer cell would die or not? I think another place where this model is very powerful is to consider heterogeneity, right? Not every cancer cell in a tumor is exactly the same. Just like in any tissue in our body, all the cells that make up that tissue are not identical. And so with the mathematical model, we can say, well, this cancer cell has a certain set of parameters. Cancer cell B has another set of parameters. Cancer cell Z has a different set of parameters. And we can predict how each of those cells' signaling pathway becomes activated and changes. And so we can ask questions, well, if 90% of the tumor is made up of cells that look like cell B, how responsive or how effective would a treatment be in order to lead that cell to go down the route of dying, apoptosis? So in the first case, again, we are predicting the dynamics. We're trying to understand what happens if you turn off a reaction, if you alter a reaction. In the second case, we can answer questions about how heterogeneity plays a role in the cell's behavior. And I really think those are two clear cases where the mathematical modeling shines that complements experimental work, but some of those experiments may be too tedious or too time consuming or require too much funding to implement, right? To try all the different combinations that with, you know, changing a parameter in a model, we can easily answer. So that's sort of where that kind of basis is for the mathematical model of apoptosis. And you could think about that analogously in other contexts as well, right? Maybe we want to stop the cell from proliferating. We have a model of proliferation. Maybe we want to activate T cells so that they can better accomplish tumor cell killing. And so we have all these kinds of models in different types of cells, but the basis is the same: to predict the dynamics, to have a framework to ask those what if question, and then also to understand the role of heterogeneity.
So then I guess I think this also kind of plays into our next question, which is, How have your collaborations with experimental and clinical researchers enhanced this type of work that you're doing? What are the most significant outcomes of these partnerships?
And I also want to add, because I think you also have the perspective of like being on these, you know, study sections and kind of seeing work that comes through. And I think as computational people in general, you know, we're used to hearing like, well, you didn't do this in mice or whatever, or, you know, like, so I think, you know, there are also people out there who would love the encouragement of like, you can do purely computational or in silico or whatever it looks like. And there's so much mm-hmm. value here. So I'd love to hear your perspective with respect to what Hijama said.
Yeah. So first I will say, right, that we have to be maybe a little bit bolder about the power of mathematical modeling and computational biology and say, yes, it's going to be grounded in biology. It's going to be grounded in data, but it can help us take the next step forward and better understand a complex system or tease out, you know, patterns in this data. So that's probably one suggestion or advice, is just to understand the power of these approaches and also understand where they're most useful. That can help make the case for a computational lab or a purely mathematical modeling laboratory. I think we do have to acknowledge, though, that our models need to be grounded in data. And so that's one place where I've been very intentional about making connections with experimental and even clinical researchers to say, well, what data is available to design and construct the mathematical model? And then on the other side, right, once I make these predictions about what happens when I turn off a reaction or when I amplify the rate of a reaction, then we need to have a prioritized list of experiment that should be performed to validate and test the model predictions. So the data and the collaborations with experimental research groups come in developing the model. And then also once we have the model and have made predictions, for validating and testing the model prediction. I have definitely like evolved in that aspect over the course of my career so far, because, you know, when you're on tenure track and you just are trying to achieve that milestone of being awarded tenure, then the timeline is very tight and you feel a lot of pressure. And so the kinds of models that we were building were really such that the data was already there and there wasn't some lead in time to collaborate with someone to generate the data. As my career has evolved, then I can have a little bit more of breathing room and say, oh, well, this is an interesting problem. We don't already have any data for it, but there's this fantastic researcher that we could collaborate with to design the experiments together that would be most informative and helpful for the model. And so that's where we can start to spend more time. Then also one way that my connections with clinical and preclinical researchers has evolved is that now I want to build models that are even closer to having an impact on patient-centered decisions. So it's not just like making the model to get the paper, to get the grant. It's more to have impact. And so then again, you have more breathing room. You can take a step back and say, well, what kinds of questions do I even want to address? And who is the right collaborator to help me address that problem? And then go at it from that angle.
Wow. I love that bit about tenure and giving you some kind of, you know, relief and flexibility to do more of the things that you find more impactful. You've also received numerous awards and honors, such as the NSF Career Award and being elected fellows of various prestigious societies. So could you tell me which one of these awards you're most proud of and why?
I'll say one that you mentioned, but also one that wasn't mentioned. So one is the NSF Career Award. NSF is, especially for the Career Award, is very much investing in early stage investigators. But another, you know, key aspect of NSF is that they want to see what the broader impacts of your research will be. And so with the Career Award, I had the chance to go into fourth grade classrooms at the school that's just across the street from USC, connect with this fantastic teacher, Miss Maxie, and introduce the students. I won't say introduce them to math, but help them see more the application of the math that they were learning in class, like fractions. So what? Like percentages. Why? Why is this useful? Help them to see some practical applications through hands-on activities and through more engaging activities. And just seeing some of the wonder in those fourth grade students' eyes was very energizing. And I think it obviously it would not have been possible without the funding support from NSF. So that's probably the one that I am really, really proud of. Another award that I was very honored to receive is the Hannah Reisler Mentoring Award from the Women in Science and Engineering program at USC. It's not something that I nominated myself for. It was something that my students and trainees thought that they would nominate me for. And I was super surprised to get the email saying that I was selected for this award in 2017. It means a lot because it was, you know, initiated by my students and trainees, but it also recognized some of the impact that I've tried to have through mentorship, right? And I'm sure that we can all identify with having bad mentors. And so I had some really fantastic mentors, and I wanted to be a good mentor to my own students. Like it's a responsibility that I treat very seriously. And so to be selected for this award was a good feeling to see that it was being recognized and that some of the work that I was putting in as a mentor was appreciated.
I love that.
And it's nice to hear that you were able to make time. I think we're told like to choose one or the other. But it's nice to hear that, you know, this is something that was literally built in and attached to, you know, something that is related to your work, your research, which is just as valuable as what I'm trying to say. So,
yeah. So looking back on your journey, what are you most grateful for and what motivates you to continue your work in this field?
Yeah, I think I'm really grateful for mentors and advocates who have helped shepherd me along the path, whether they were in academia or not. That has been very impactful. And, you know, speaking my name in places where I'm not present and being able to be an advocate and a supporter from near or from afar. I'm very grateful for fantastic mentors and advocates along the way, including Dr. Stevens, including my scholarship advisor at FAMU, Ms. Azanobi, including my PhD advisor, Linda Broadbelt, and also Vasily Hatzimarakatis, all these people who have played important roles. So very grateful for that. Also just grateful for the privilege of being a faculty member, right? It's something that you can easily, you know, begrudge and take for granted, but it is, you know, it's an opportunity to do science that I enjoy, to mentor brilliant and very motivated and successful PhD students and postdocs, and also to have some freedom, right, in the things that I pursue. And so I never want to take that for granted. So I am very grateful just for the opportunity to be a faculty member too.
Well, Stacey, thank you so much for sharing everything you did today. Also, for those who don't know, Stacey was on our flagship board when BWCB was very young and honestly didn't know what we were doing, but has been a constant support and just someone who continues to uplift us. And I just feel so grateful to be able to talk to you today about your journey in more detail. And I feel happy that people will also get to hear more about it as well. So thank you.
No, this is a great pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Of course. So thank you all to our listeners. And again, if you have any questions or comments, especially for Dr. Finley, we'd love to hear your thoughts on them through our email, podcast@blackwomencompbio.org. We also accept voicemails, 302-715-BWCB. And once again, I'm Janae.
And I'm Melissa.
And we'll see you in the next episode. The Comp Bio Cafe podcast is brought to you by Ijama Miramiku, Melissa Minto, and Janae Adams. Learn more about us at blackwomencompbio.org and also tap into ways that you can become a member or a supporter today. Thank you for listening.